which was on James's side of the bed. "Thanks," she said as he handed it to her.
"Thank you," James responded, becoming Jack Nicholson again. "Thank you for putting such a positive spin on things. I'll get used to it. There's still food and wine, sleeping and television. That's enough to get me through the remaining 4 decades.
"Stop," Laura told him, turning to face the other direction to put on her bra. "Please, stop." Her voice shook. "I don't understand why you're being so mean."
"Oh, did I offend you?"
he said with sarcastic glee. "You're suggesting a life without sex is a terrible life," Laura said. "How's that supposed to make me feel?" She stood up and located the rest of her clothes. "Do you not see how that's hurtful?" she continued, turning to face him as she pulled up her knee socks.
"No," he said with a righteous smirk, "because if I heard you correctly, you just said you've lived your whole life without it and are perfectly happy. Well, it's been nearly a year for me, and I'm fucking miserable."
"I wish you and Emma the best," Laura said. Tucking her turtleneck into the waist of her Laura Ashley skirt, she headed toward the door.
"Before you leave and we never see each other again," he called from across the room, "can I ask you a question that's also a piece of advice?"
Laura braced herself.
"Let me think of the most delicate way to put this."
Propped up against the headboard, James folded his arms across his chest.
"You're a beautiful woman, Laura, but you don't dress the part."
"That's not a question, nor is it a piece of advice," Laura responded. "But if you're critiquing my wardrobe, you might be interested to know that Bill Cunningham took a photo of me in a variation of this outfit that appeared in the New York Times." James looked amused by this fact, if a little skeptical.
"When was this?" he asked.
"Spring of 1979, Laura told him, "at the beginning of his career."
"It's 1991, he said. "Do yourself a favor, kiddo. Go shopping."
"And can I give you one piece of advice?" Laura's heart beat wildly as she tried to think of an insult.
"You're a cad," she said.
"And my advice is, in the future, if you're dating multiple women, I think it's only fair to let all parties know."
"I agree, but we weren't exactly dating, Laura. I mean, we hadn't even slept together."
"Thank goodness for that," Laura said, shutting the door behind her. Right as she emerged from the building, she thought of a better comeback. How interesting it was that he was so critical of her clothes when she'd heard his ex wasn't exactly Miss Fashion USA. But to go all the way back up to his floor again just to deliver this would look pathetic. If only she'd thought of it at the time. And, she realized a few blocks later, it wasn't his ex. It was his dead wife. The mother of his Emma. She would have felt horrible if she'd said that. Sometimes it paid not to be so quick-witted. In first grade, Emma had removed the Kids XXX Large sticker from a new pair of Gap leggings and stuck it to the base of the wall of their elevator. The experiment was to see how long it stayed there before someone peeled it off. Weeks, then months, then a whole year passed, and then another year, followed by another and another, until it was no longer an experiment, but a matter-of-fact reality of her life. It was just there, something Emma saw every day. And then one day, it wasn't. Just the spot where it had been, a shade lighter than what surrounded it. Laura had always taken meticulous care of her teeth. She flossed and brushed twice a day, and though she was skeptical of the need for biannual dental cleanings, she never missed an appointment. She was shocked at the age of 42 to learn that she had a cavity. It was her first filling. Dr. Morton, whose office was 3 doors down from 136 and had been her dentist since childhood, seemed amused when she firmly declined his offer of nitrous oxide.
"Your mother loved it," he said. "Absolutely loved it."
The procedure wasn't as bad as people made it out to be, but the Novocaine left Laura's mouth numb,
making it difficult to speak afterward. Dr. Morton said the feeling should come back in about an hour. Rather than returning to work lisping, Laura decided to wait it out at 136. It was Tuesday, Sandra's day off, but as Laura let herself in, she thought she heard someone moving around upstairs.
"Hello?" she called.
"Yes?" a voice called back. It was Stephanie. A moment later, she appeared at the top of the stairs wearing glasses and pajamas. They were both confused to see each other.
"I can't understand you," Stephanie said, as Laura tried to explain about the Novocaine. "Are you okay?"
"Dentist," Laura said. "Coming from dentist."
"You were just at the dentist." Stephanie grasped her chest and smiled. "Thank God. For a moment, I was scared. Your face looks weird. I thought you might have had a stroke or something."
Laura smiled back and shook her head. Stephanie explained that they were living at 136 while their kitchen was being renovated.
"It was only supposed to be a week, but now they're saying 2.
She rolled her eyes.
"You know how it is. Hold on, let me get dressed and come down."
Laura went into the kitchen. The breakfast table was a mess of dishes and newspaper.
"Please don't do that," Stephanie said, stepping in a moment later. "Please don't clean up after us."
After a moment of deliberation, Laura peeled off her rubber gloves and stepped away from the sink.
"It's so nice outside," Stephanie said. "Let's go sit in the garden."
Stephanie opened the fridge and took out a Diet Coke. Then she grabbed a box of Melba toast from the cupboard.
"It's so funny you're here," Stephanie said as they went out to the garden, "because I've been wanting to call you. I need your advice on something."
Laura nodded encouragingly.
"Maybe it's not the best time, though," Stephanie said, "if it hurts you to talk."
"Doesn't hurt," Laura said. "Just hard to enunciate."
They sat down on the two chaise lounges.
"Do you think it's selfish to only have one child?" Stephanie asked without turning her head. "When you're in the position to have more?"
Laura shook her head with conviction. "To the contrary, with overpopulation, the state of your planet and limited resources is a conscionable choice."
"I'm sorry," Stephanie said. "I'm having a hard time understanding you. Let me get you something to write on."
She went inside and came out with a pen and yellow legal pad. "Opposite of selfish," Laura wrote. "Good for planet." Laura passed the pad to Stephanie, who read it with a worried frown. This didn't appear to be the answer she was looking for.
"But what if you're not thinking of the Earth, just yourself and what you want?"
"It's wise to recognize what you want," Laura wrote. "No one should have a child they don't want."
"It took me so long to feel like myself again after having Nick. I don't know if I have it in me to go through that again. But everyone expects you to have 2.
Laura responded, "I wouldn't feel pressured to do anything just because it's the conventional thing to do." Stephanie stared at the message.
"This sun feels good, doesn't it?"
She adjusted the seat of her chaise so that it was in the reclining position. Then she lay back and shut her eyes. Laura did the same. They lay there in silence for what felt like 15 or 20 minutes, but it might have been more. Lulled by the heat of the flagstone and the fricative hiss of traffic and other city sounds that snaked around them oblivious, the impermeable serenity of a Manhattan courtyard, Laura was on the verge of sleep when Stephanie spoke again.
"My mother says if I don't give Nick Jr. a brother or sister, he'll grow up thinking the sun rises to hear him crow."
Laura was taken aback that Stephanie would say this to her. She felt as though she'd been slapped.
"It's a southern expression," Stephanie explained, sitting up. "It means someone who thinks the world revolves around..."
"I get it," Laura said, her mouth working again. "But I don't think that's the case with Emma. She certainly likes attention, has her theatrical impulses." Laura's cheeks grew hot, recalling her performance at Stephanie's wedding. "But that's a part of who she is, how she's wired. It has nothing to do with being an only child."
"Oh, no, I didn't mean to imply that." Now Stephanie's cheeks were also red. "Emma's a great kid, a spunky gal. You've done a wonderful job with her.
You don't need to say that, Laura said.
I mean it. I think you're a very good mom.
Thank you. So are you.
Stephanie brushed Melba toast crumbs off her lap.
I love Nick Jr. to death, she said, but I'm not good at the day-to-day things, making sure his lunch is ready, taking him to appointments and playdates, keeping track of everything. I wish I were more like you in that area. You're so in control of everything.
Well, thank you, Laura repeated, though this time it sounded less complimentary.
That's why I wanted your advice on this situation we're dealing with.
Stephanie looked down and wriggled the tab of her can of Diet Coke until it broke off.
This awful decision we have to make.
You're pregnant, Laura said, suddenly realizing.
We just found out, Stephanie answered. It was an accident.
They were quiet. Now the sounds of the city seemed amplified, the honking of a horn, the trilling of birds, a low-flying helicopter passing overhead.
It took a long time to get where we are right now. Things are good, and when I think about another baby...
Stephanie's shoulders collapsed as she covered her face with her hands.
I just can't. I can't go through with it.
You don't have to.
Laura reached out to tap the top of Stephanie's manicured hand, but Stephanie pulled it away.
I never thought of myself as the type of person who would...
Lots of women have them, Laura said.
Not where I come from.
I'm sure they do, said Laura gently. They just don't talk about it.
Have you ever had one? Stephanie asked, raising her eyebrows in a hopeful way.
Laura shook her head. How does Nicholas feel about it?
He says he wants me to make the decision, but I can tell he doesn't want me to keep it. He's scared of what would happen if we had to go through what we went through the first time.
She paused.
Nicholas doesn't like it when I'm upset. He really can't handle it. I've never told anyone this, because I don't want them to think bad of Nicholas, but when I cry,
she lowered her voice to a whisper.
Instead of comforting me, he gets mad.
Oh dear, Laura said, ashamed of her brother. I'm sorry about that.
It's not your fault, Stephanie said. I figure it's just one of those things, like how you were saying about Emma being who she is. It's the way he is.
He wasn't always like that, Laura said.
When he was little, I mean, she added, worried that Stephanie might think she was accusing her of being responsible for the change. Stephanie delicately pinched two fingers over her nostrils and sneezed twice, a dainty pachoo, pachoo.
I can't go through with it, she said.
Laura wasn't sure if she meant the abortion or the pregnancy.
Does that make me a horrible person?
No, Laura said firmly, absolutely not.
This sounds silly, she said, but I can't bring myself to tell my OBGYN.
I can give you the name of mine. He's very good.
Does he definitely...
Do this? Stephanie asked. Yes, Laura shielded her eyes from the sun.
I believe so.
'92.
As Laura flipped through the morning paper, she came across some disconcerting news. An asteroid was passing by the Earth that day. A collision was not expected, nor had it been ruled out. In the words of one scientist, as advanced as our technology is, we can never truly predict what will happen. This could be it. But it wasn't. The asteroid cruised right on by and continued on its merry, sweet way through the universe. And so their lives continued, much as they had before, and in what felt like the blink of an eye, Emma was suddenly no longer quite a child, but not yet a teenager. A preteen adolescent, Laura supposed it was called.
'94.
I thought you were going to the homeless shelter, Emma said as Laura swooshed by in a floor-length dress.
I am. Tonight is their art show. What do you think?
The hem of the skirt grazed the walls of the hallway as she twirled.
Fancy. You don't even get that dressed up for events at the library.
Laura considered this. These women work very hard every year to put this exhibition of their work together, and only a few people show up. Maybe you're right, though. This dress is a little much. I wore it in Susie's wedding. Can you tell it's a bridesmaid's dress?
No, you should definitely wear it.
You look pretty, and the women will like it.
The phone rang. Emma ran to get it. It was mostly for her these days.
It's Margaret, she shouted from the kitchen.
I'll take it in the bedroom, Laura shouted back.
Lordy Lord, what a day, Margaret responded to Laura's hello. Tripp's going to call Miss Gardner tomorrow.
I'm too emotional to handle it. You spend $14,000.
Handle what?
You mean Emma didn't tell you?
I have no clue what you're talking about.
That awful teacher. She had to be referring to Mr. Vincent, a new language arts teacher who was unpopular with the girls.
He called her the B-word.
Brat?
No, Laura. Bitch. At the tender age of 12, such an ugly misogynistic slur.
Out of the blue?
Yes, in front of the whole class. He lost his notes or something, and he took it out on Charlotte. He called her a bitch. Can you believe it? $14,000 a year, sending your daughter to an all-girls school to protect her from this sort of thing, only to have it thrown in her face.
Well, it could have been worse. It was the best Laura could think of to say. At least it wasn't cunt.
What's a cunt? Emma asked when Laura got off the phone.
Did you listen to my phone call with Margaret?
I had to, Mom. I needed to hear what she was saying. She's totally overreacting. Why is Tripp calling Miss Gardner? It would be ridiculous if Mr. Vincent got fired. First of all, he called everyone a bitch, not just Charlotte. Second of all,
everyone in the whole class? Laura winced. Even sweet little Scarlet Wang?
Emma rolled her eyes.
Mom, don't worry. It wasn't like how Margaret explained it to you. He was stressed because it's the week Miss Gardner randomly comes into classes to grade the teachers. All week, he's been especially stuttery. So, before class starts, he writes out the entire lesson on the chalkboard, so if the problem gets really bad, he can just point to whatever he's trying to teach us. Today, he realized he forgot to make us copies of our assignment, so he told Scarlet Wang to be in charge while he went to the teacher's lounge. 10 minutes later, he came back, and Charlotte had erased everything he'd written on the board. He didn't say anything, but you could tell he was pissed. His face just turned bright red, and he wrote everything on the board all over again.
Emma shook her head remorsefully.
He was still writing everything on the board when Miss Gardner came in. He didn't hear the door open or notice her. He just kept on writing. I felt really bad, because aren't teachers supposed to interact with students?
Laura put her face in her hands.
After 5 or 10 minutes, he was still writing on the board, Emma continued, and Miss Gardner got up and left. This time, he heard the door and turned around. We told him it was Miss Gardner, that she'd been there and left. He smiled and made a face like, very funny. Then he looked at Scarlet Wang, and she verified this was true.
Validated, Laura said, or verified.
Same difference. Anyway, so after he finds out it was Miss Gardner, he walks over to the board and pretends to bang his head against it, and Charlotte goes, somebody needs to take a chill pill, and that's when he says it. Bitches.
What's a chill pill?
It's an expression. It means you're acting like a spaz.
And then what?
And everyone laughed, except me, because it stopped being funny to me. It was like when Tanya Harding's shoelace broke at the Olympics right before she was about to go on. I felt bad for him, Mom. I really did.
Emma's forehead creased with emotion. She wiggled a loose cuticle on her thumb, then ripped it off. To tell you the truth, she said, sucking the blood off her finger, I don't blame him for saying the word, because that's what we were acting like.
Emma was troubled to arrive at school the next day and discover that Mr. Vincent, who was also her homeroom teacher, was absent. Mrs. Gregg, the permanent sub, delivered that morning's announcements and escorted her class to prayers. They filed into the auditorium in the customary 2x2 procession. Emma hadn't memorized that week's Bible verses, so as the recitation began, she mouthed the word watermelon over and over again. Next came the Lord's Prayer, which she knew by heart. After this, Miss Gardner walked to the podium and read a story about a flock of geese, who all stopped flying when one of the birds was shot by a hunter and fell to the ground. The bird didn't die, and the whole flock waited around for it to recover before resuming their journey north. When she was done, Miss Gardner asked the room what the lesson was, and, as usual, the only hands that went up were in the front, where the younger grades sat. When Emma heard Miss Gardner call on Isabel, she thought it must have been another Isabel. There were a few. But looking up, Emma saw it was the Isabel in first grade, who had stopped coming to school after being diagnosed with leukemia earlier that year. She was back. Isabel wore a headband with a bow on it, as it appeared that she was completely bald. However, as Mrs. Hudson played the opening chords to Amazing Grace, and Isabel turned to face the scroll with the words on it, her scalp caught the light, and Emma could see that her hair was growing in. Not a lot, just wisps, like a dandelion gone to seed. They were still stuck in February, but the light that filtered through the windows had a yolky glow. Spring was coming. Soon there would be blossoms on the trees, and Isabel, who was not going to die after all, would have enough hair to tuck behind her ears. To the tune of Amazing Grace, Emma contemplated the miracle of these things, and she was overwhelmed with a feeling of goodness and the blissful serenity that accompanies seeing the world through the simplicity of this lens. As the singing continued, the feeling intensified, and then, like a bolt of lightning, it suddenly occurred to Emma what really mattered in life. It wasn't about cool versus uncool, pretty versus ugly, funny versus boring, or even happy versus sad. But goodness, goodness versus everything else that might not seem bad, but wasn't good either. To do good things, to be a good person, this was all that really counted. With a sudden clarity that felt holy, Emma considered her own life through this prism. She had done some things that were not good. She'd known this, and yet she'd done them anyway because up to this moment, she'd wanted to be like Naughty Joe in Little Women. But now, she realized, she actually wanted to be like Joe's saintly sister, Beth. And maybe she was already more like Beth than she'd thought.
"Are you crying?" Charlotte whispered.
Emma let her face speak for itself as she continued to sing. That this was her favorite of all the hymns in the rotating roster they sang in prayers was no coincidence. Amazing Grace. Isabel's hair growing back. Her complicity in Mr. Vincent's unexplained absence, all of these things felt predestined to deliver her right now to this place inside of her. A place within that she'd always known was there, but had never consciously lingered. Amazing Grace ended. Emma's tears dried and the goosebumps subsided. But the feeling of goodness and the newfound belief that she was, at her core, an exceptionally good person, these sentiments remained. For the rest of the day, she carried it around. It felt like a huge secret, like she'd just found out she'd won an award and couldn't tell anyone. But she didn't care, because there was no vanity in goodness. Emboldened by her new convictions, Emma cut herself off from Charlotte, and in doing so, Claire, Eleanor C., Leslie, and Ashley, who Emma now realized hadn't been her friends, but followers of Charlotte, whom everybody wanted to be around because she made things fun. The clique, or the posse, Emma learned they were called by the rest of their classmates, the social proletariat, of which she was now a member. Sitting for the first time at a different table in the lunchroom, it depressed Emma how preoccupied her new circle was with her old one. It seemed,
Half the conversation was about the posse. In a transparent attempt to mask their sense of inferiority, they spoke of Charlotte and company in strictly hostile terms. Even more pathetic was that their actual interactions with members of the clique were shamelessly obsequious. Charlotte was quick to replace Emma with Leslie as her best friend and sat next to her when the class didn't have assigned seating. One day, Leslie emerged from the bathroom with the back of her skirt tucked into the waist of her underpants. It was recess, and Emma was one of about a dozen witnesses who'd been sitting in the locker cove, the only one who hadn't leapt up and chased her down the hall in a frantic scramble to heroically alert her before she could embarrass herself. Emma watched Leslie wave them off with a smile and continue on her exposed pink butt-cheek way.
"She knows. She tucked it in on purpose. It's for a dare,"
so explained the Committee of Concerned Citizens upon returning to the locker cove.
"They all have to do something," someone testified. "Everyone in the clique wrote a dare on a piece of paper, and whoever picked that slip has to do it."
"Charlotte has to leave a condominium on Monsieur Durant's desk," another added in a whisper.
This elicited a chorus of laughter.
"A condom! A condom!" everyone corrected her.
That was the day Emma decided to disassociate herself from everyone in the whole grade. What did it matter if she didn't have friends? To do good things, to be a good person, this was what counted. A new high-rise was going up one block north of them. A self-proclaimed luxury building. It was called the Parkview. The name was ironic, as once upon a time, Laura had been able to look out her bedroom window and see a band of green that was the tops of the trees in Central Park. Now, this ugly tower blocked the view. It was so upsetting that she began thinking of it as a temporary thing. One morning she'd wake up, and it would be gone. View restored. But no, not only was it here to stay, it was growing taller by the day. But then something remarkable happened that affirmed Laura's more optimistic feelings about the universe. A local anti-high-rise activist had been keeping tabs on the building's skyward trajectory, and according to his count, its height exceeded the legal zoning limit by 12 stories. The authorities were notified, and justice was served. The building's contractors were forced to take down the additional floors. The New York Times wrote an article about it, which Laura cut out and put on the fridge. "After their cityscape has crept ever closer to the clouds over the decades," it began, "Manhattanites are about to witness something decidedly uncommon, a shrinking skyscraper." A few weeks into Emma's new life, a condom was left with an anonymous note on the desk of a controversial middle school French teacher, and Emma was among those Miss Gardner summoned to her office for an interrogation. To avoid speaking the word, Miss Gardner referred to it as an object used for adult purposes, and seeing this wasn't ringing any bells for Emma, had no choice but to show her the item, which she procured from a drawer in her desk and daintily held up in a Ziploc bag.
"The nature of the note left us very concerned," Miss Gardner said, quickly slipping the contraband back into the drawer. "We are in the process of trying to determine who might have left it. Anything you know will remain confidential."
It was then that Emma realized she'd been singled out not as a suspect, but as a tattletale.
"I would guess the sixth graders," Emma offered.
"It appeared the week they were away at Frost Valley," Miss Gardner said. "If you hear anything, I would appreciate it if you passed it along to me."
Miss Gardner held Emma's gaze for a few seconds, then nodded to indicate she was dismissed. After Emma stepped out of the office, Leslie jumped out from around the corner.
"What did she want to talk to you about?" she demanded.
"Cunt." The word slipped out like a fart. Emma glanced down the hall, terrified a teacher might have heard.
"What did you just say?" Leslie asked.
"I can't talk about it," Emma said, and walked briskly away.
"Trip snores," Margaret said out of the blue. "Loudly." Laura nodded sympathetically. They were at Sarah Beth's. It was Margaret's birthday, and Laura was taking her out for lunch. This used to be a biannual tradition, treating each other to lunch on their birthdays. The ritual slowed down when the girls had arrived. Now, neither of them could remember the last time they'd done it. The waiter approached to take their orders.
"We're going to need a few," Margaret told him. Turning back to Laura, she said, "Anywho, it was really bad last night, which is why I look 80 years old today."
"I think you look great," Laura said, though it was true she looked tired. "Have you tried earplugs?"
"I've tried it all," Margaret said dismally. "Earplugs, Valium, pillow over his face. Doesn't work."
"I've been sleeping very poorly lately, too," Laura told her.
"I was always a great sleeper," Margaret shook her head wistfully, until Trip gained 30 pounds and started snoring. Margaret lowered her voice to add, "My shrink says that's the likely cause."
"You have a shrink?" Laura asked.
"I've joined the club," Margaret said. "Sometimes I'll roll over and look at him laying there all slack-jawed." Margaret did an impression. "Snoring, drooling, snoring, his side of the blanket rising and falling. And I'll think to myself, it's a good thing I'm not one of those people who sleeps with a gun in my bedside drawer."
Laura laughed.
"Because if I had a gun," Margaret continued, unsmiling, "I would shoot him."
Laura tried to think of a more cheerful topic.
"I would shoot him," Margaret repeated.
"You remember what my mother used to say about marriage," Laura said.
"Yes," Margaret's scowl softened. "But tell me again."
"She'd say, it doesn't matter who you marry, one day you'll be sitting across a table from him thinking, anything would be better than this."
Margaret smiled. "I miss your mother," she said.
"We should figure out what we're ordering," Laura said, putting on her newly acquired reading glasses so she could see the menu. In the hard-boiled light of the day, it never seemed urgent, where and when and how to dispose of them in a ceremonious manner. But in the middle of the night, it struck Laura as unacceptable. It had been almost 4 years, and her mother's ashes were still sitting on top of the bedroom bookshelf where she'd put them after her trip to Central Park, when she'd hallucinated Woody Allen. They weren't even in a proper urn, but in the tin container they'd been delivered in, like a box of cookies from some houseguest, relegated to the back of the kitchen cupboard, only discovered when it's time to move, at which point they get discarded. The Winthrop faculty attributed Emma's sudden status as a social pariah to her dramatic transformation as a student. Overnight, it seemed, Emma went from being easily distracted, disorganized, frequently unprepared, and clearly not the slightest bit concerned with her academic performance, to being extremely focused, meticulously organized, punctual, thorough, and highly invested in her grades. In classes without assigned seating, she chose to sit in the middle of the front row, where she became a regular and enthusiastic participant in class discussions. There was no more silliness in music class, giggle fits during prayers, or subversive behavior of any kind. In all her endeavors throughout the day, she conducted herself with unwavering poise, self-respect, and deference for authority. Even her handwriting was different. Once, swollen and sloppy and frequently spilling beyond the margins of the lines in her loose-leaf notebooks, now it was small, neat, and contained, as though it had suddenly become aware of itself and was eager to make a good impression. Miss Gardner called Laura in to relay all this and commend Emma for becoming a model of the Winthrop way. Laura found herself distracted by the presence of Mrs. Jones, the school social worker. Miss Gardner began by conveying how impressed she was with Emma's newfound maturity and priorities. Then, she shifted her gaze to Mrs. Jones, who asked Laura if she had noticed any changes in Emma's behavior at home. Yes, she had. Each night before bed, Emma laid out her outfit for the next day on the armchair in the corner of her bedroom, kilt, turtleneck, socks, and shoes. Then, she wrote a little to-do list for the next morning. Make bed, brush teeth, check forecast. Her once messy bedroom was now immaculate, and she'd begun chiding Laura for her habit of allowing miscellaneous clutter to accumulate on the front hall table. She no longer had to be pestered to do her homework. She completed this first thing upon arriving home. Once finished, rather than turning on the TV, she took out a book. She'd gotten very into reading, in particular books about children with fatal illnesses. There was a section devoted to such books in the local Barnes & Noble. Right now, she was reading Ryan White, My Own Story, the autobiography of a boy who contracted HIV through a blood transfusion. For Christmas, she wanted to adopt a starving child from Ethiopia. "Oh my," Miss Gardner said in response to this detail. "Not literally," Laura explained. "Just sponsor."
"Adolescence is a difficult time for girls," Mrs. Jones spoke up.
"We are a little concerned," Miss Gardner said, "that Emma may feel alienated from her classmates."
"The phone doesn't ring for her anymore," Laura reflected. "There are fewer playdates and invitations to birthday parties."
Laura wished she hadn't said this out loud. She resented the portrait Miss Gardner was painting. It spoke to Emma's integrity and character that she had chosen to set herself apart from her spoiled cliquish cohorts to the detriment of her popularity. To be socially successful at Winthrop was at odds with her and Emma's values. Laura couldn't say this to Miss Gardner, of course, and the meeting concluded on an unresolved note. Laura was encouraged when, a few weeks later, Emma announced she would be joining the middle school track team. Though she'd never been particularly athletic or drawn to physical activity, Emma's interest in running quickly blossomed into a passion. Runner's World magazine began arriving in the mail. In addition to attending afternoon practice, Emma started setting her alarm an hour early to run up and down the stairs in their building. Concerned with the nutritional value of their meals, she refused to eat certain things, including butter, to which she had developed a sudden aversion.
"When you were a baby, it was your favorite food," Laura told her.
"It was one of your first words. You called it cheese."
"You let me eat pure butter?" Emma asked, horrified.
One issue of Runner's World featured an advertisement for running camp. Laura found the concept of a 4-week sleepaway camp whose sole activity was jogging utterly bizarre, but Emma really wanted to go, and perhaps it would be an opportunity to make new friends. As a little girl, Emma's blonde locks had received much attention, from relatives and acquaintances to strangers in elevators and supermarkets. Afterward, she would often ask Laura to repeat the compliment. It reminded Laura of how Bibbs, when praised for something, would frequently respond, "And what do you like about it?" Her mother's ego had been like a hole that got bigger as you filled it. Laura's instinct had always been not to comment on Emma's physical appearance unless her opinion was solicited. But when she arrived to pick Emma up from running camp, it was hard not to say something. She didn't look good. Her eyes were too big, the contour of her jaw too sharp. When she turned to pick up her suitcase, the wings of her shoulder blades emerged from her back like a piece of mechanical machinery. Her legs, while slimmer, still lacked definition, but everything else was jarringly pronounced. Laura thought of how she'd used to marvel at having given birth to this plump, excitable, self-possessed little girl who subscribed to her own romantic notions of how the world worked. Whatever it was that had fueled her unruly ways, her tempestuous appetites for life, it was as if someone had inserted a straw into her veins and sucked it out. In the past, whenever Emma had been sick, Laura's heart had percolated with a love so fierce it had hurt. It disturbed her that she was unable to access such maternal feelings now. It was so noticeable, so upsetting, that Laura thought she should call Stephanie ahead of time and let her know that she would be shocked to see Emma. And she was, but not in the way Laura had expected. When they arrived for dinner at Nicholas's apartment, upon opening the front door, Stephanie gasped.
"It's skinny Minnie Emma," she twilled, throwing her arms around her bony shoulders. "You look beautiful."
Laura had never managed to develop a rapport with Dr. Marks, Emma's new pediatrician, the way she had with Dr. Brown. This was fine. Laura had no interest in a friendship with this woman, whose reputation as one of the city's top pediatricians was clearly not earned for her bedside manner. Dr. Marks' lovely South African accent did little to mitigate her strictly business, clinically brusque demeanor. It was known that Dr. Marks had no patience for neurotic parents, which her practice was full of, and so, eager to establish herself as an exception, Laura made a conscious effort not to bring Emma in too often, or ask too many questions. Her restraint had earned her credibility, which meant that when she called the office asking if she could speak to the doctor before Emma's annual back-to-school physical, Dr. Marks returned her call right away. Laura explained that her concern about Emma's weight loss was exacerbated by the positive reception it received from others. In addition to Stephanie, several acquaintances they'd bumped into on the street also commented on Emma's appearance in the affirmative. "I've been holding my tongue. These days anything I say is the wrong thing," Laura said. "But if you could say something to her." The days of accompanying Emma into the exam room were over. After her examination, Laura was called in to speak with the doctor privately.
"Her BMI is in the 37th percentile," Dr. Marks said. "It's on the leaner side, but still within the normal range." "But she used to be on the rounder side," Laura pointed out. "It just feels like out of the blue she stopped being interested in dessert and started jogging. When we go to Jackson Hole, she never orders her favorite things. Onion rings, milkshakes, grilled cheese. She gets the French onion soup, minus the cheese on top." "It's normal for adolescents to slim down as they get older and make healthier decisions," Dr. Mark said. "I wouldn't worry about it." "Why did she want to talk to you?" Emma asked as they walked home. "She just wanted to go over your booster shots," Laura said. "But I didn't get any shots." "Right," said Laura. "She was explaining why you didn't need any." On their way back, Laura bought a box of Entenmann's chocolate donuts, which Emma used to beg her to buy. Emma ate a few bites of one for dessert and threw the rest away. Yesterday's science lab had involved looking at plant cells, onion, under a microscope. Today's sample would be animal, human. The cells would come from their mouths. That's what the toothpicks were for. Emma opened her mouth and scraped the toothpick along the inside of her cheek, but when she pulled it out, nothing was on it. Applying more pressure, she tried a second time, and again, no luck. She began poking and prodding, and eventually punctured the surface of the skin. A little nodule came loose. Since it was too small to spear and tear, she bit and spat. Voila! There it was in the cradle of her palm, raw and pink and glistening, the size of a frozen pea. A moment ago it had been a part of her body. Now it was a separate thing. Emma's tongue probed the spot where it had been. There must have been a little bit of blood because her mouth tasted like a dime. "What's that?" Mrs. Mullen asked, frowning at Emma's sample. Mrs. Mullen's ingratiating floral perfume did not match her disgusted and irritated countenance. It took Emma a moment to realize her error. What she held in her hand was much too big. Cells were so small they were invisible. That's what the microscope was for. Duh. Mrs. Mullen continued to hover, waiting for an answer, her eyelids coming halfway down so that all you saw were the whites of her eyes, something that happened when she lost her patience or had to explain something twice. "That's my cells," Emma told her.
"Those are your what?"
"My cells," Emma repeated, a drop of bloody drool landing on her lab report. "From my cheek?"
"That's a lot more cells than necessary," Mrs. Mullen said with a look of repugnance. Emma's anxiety was laced with shame. She would be more careful moving forward. As Laura often said, less is more.
When Emma woke up the next morning, her tongue explored the perforation, and it was just as prominent as it had been the night before.
The cells would not grow back. The landscape of Emma's mouth was permanently altered. For the rest of her life it would be there, this little crater, and when she was at a loss for words, it was where her tongue would go.
People who knew her well would come to notice it.
"You're making that face," they'd say. "You're hiding something." All homework, no playdates. Emma's funk continued in seventh grade. Beneath the melancholy was an anger, but apparently it only came out at home. According to her teachers, she was a pleasure to have in class. Her language arts teacher, an uppity young thing who was a new addition to the faculty, was particularly impressed. During their parent-teacher meeting, she showed Laura a copy of a story Emma had written. Precociously titled, "A Tree Grows on the Upper East Side," it depicted the life of an emotionally neglected only child, whose high-powered, aggressive businesswoman mother didn't have a maternal bone in her body. In one scene, the daughter tried to hug her mother, who coldly rejected her. "Oh, please, I'm your mother, not your lover."
"But I never said that," Laura told the teacher.
"Of course you didn't," she said with a laugh.
"This is fiction. We won't be studying memoir until the spring."
"How wonderful to have such a creative daughter," she added when Laura didn't respond.
Emma was clearly unhappy. There was no doubt about that. Laura thought it would be nice for her to have someone to talk to, an adult who wasn't a teacher or her mother. Those were her exact words, and they were the wrong ones.
Emma flew into a rage.
"Because you're saying you don't want to listen to me, so you'll pay someone else to do it?"
Laura tried to defend and explain herself, but it only made it worse, and that was the end of that conversation. It was ironic when Laura thought about it. No sooner had Emma started walking than people began telling Laura what she was in for. "Good luck with that one. You think she's a handful now? Just wait till she's a teenager." Now here she was, and from an outsider's perspective, an exception to the trend, the rare docile adolescent, respectful and polite, pleasant to be around.
"She's like that cliché about March," Margaret observed. "Started out like a lion, is now a lamb."
Laura bit her tongue. Often she would propose doing something such as a picnic in the park, and Emma would affect an enthusiastic smile.
"I have a better idea," she'd reply, briefly raising Laura's hopes before the sarcastic kicker. "Let's not, and say we did."
Emma would ridicule things Laura said by repeating them in a high-pitched English accent. She grew increasingly intolerant of certain habits Laura had, singing to herself in the kitchen, saying okey-doke upon concluding a task, clearing her throat.
"You don't do that at work, do you?" she'd ask.
Then there was the outrageous accusation that Laura, who, when communicating with immigrants, made an effort to speak slowly, enunciate clearly, and use simple, direct language, was mocking these people, insulting their intelligence and dignity.
"How would you feel if someone spoke to you like this?"
Laura was racist, too, of course. Only a racist would lock her doors when approaching a red light at 125th Street in Harlem. In restaurants, when Laura ordered a Coca-Cola Classic, you had to say classic, otherwise waiters assumed diet, given that's what everyone ordered these days. Emma covered her face in her hands.
"It's normal to find your mother irritating," Laura told her.
"Yeah, well, newsflash, Mom, I'm not the only one who finds you irritating," was Emma's cruelly cryptic response.
It was tradition that the seventh graders put on a Christmas talent show. Laura remembered it from her days. She had worn white gloves and played the C and D bells in a handbell performance of "God Rest Ye Merry Gentlemen." In addition to the younger grades, parents were invited to be part of the audience. To Laura's surprise, both of her parents had shown up. Each time it was Laura's turn to ring a note, Bibbs had giggled. All the seventh graders were expected to be part of the production, though this year, one had declined to appear on stage, electing instead to be the solitary technical crew member. Dressed in black, Emma stood on the balcony behind the spotlight, shining it on whoever's moment it was.
"1994. I thought you were going to the homeless shelter,"
Emma said as Laura swooshed by in a floor-length dress.
I am. Tonight is their art show. What do you think?
The hem of the skirt grazed the walls of the hallway as she twirled.
Fancy. You don't even get that dressed up for events at the library.
Laura considered this.
These women work very hard every year to put this exhibition of their work together, and only a few people show up.
Maybe you're right, though. This dress is a little much. I wore it in Susie's wedding. Can you tell it's a bridesmaid's dress?
No, you should definitely wear it. You look pretty, and the women will like it.
The phone rang. Emma ran to get it. It was mostly for her these days.
It's Margaret, she shouted from the kitchen. I'll take it in the bedroom, Laura shouted back.
Lordy Lord, what a day, Margaret responded to Laura's hello. Tripp's going to call Miss Gardner tomorrow. I'm too emotional to handle it. You spend $14,000.
Handle what?
You mean Emma didn't tell you?
I have no clue what you're talking about.
That awful teacher. She had to be referring to Mr. Vincent, a new language arts teacher who was unpopular with the girls.
He called her the B word.
Brat?
No, Laura, bitch. At the tender age of 12, such an ugly misogynistic slur.
Out of the blue?
Yes, in front of the whole class. He lost his notes or something, and he took it out on Charlotte. He called her a bitch. Can you believe it? $14,000 a year, sending your daughter to an all-girls school to protect her from this sort of thing, only to have it thrown in her face.
Well, it could have been worse. It was the best Laura could think of to say. At least it wasn't cunt.
What's a cunt? Emma asked when Laura got off the phone.
Did you listen to my phone call with Margaret?
I had to, Mom. I needed to hear what she was saying. She's totally overreacting. Why is Tripp calling Miss Gardner? It would be ridiculous if Mr. Vincent got fired. First of all, he called everyone a bitch, not just Charlotte. Second of all,
everyone in the whole class? Laura winced. Even sweet little Scarlet Wang? Emma rolled her eyes.
Mom, don't worry. It wasn't like how Margaret explained it to you. He was stressed because it's the week Miss Gardner randomly comes into classes to grade the teachers. All week, he's been especially stuttery. So, before class starts, he writes out the entire lesson on the chalkboard, so if the problem gets really bad, he can just point to whatever he's trying to teach us. Today, he realized he forgot to make us copies of our assignment, so he told Scarlet Wang to be in charge while he went to the teacher's lounge. 10 minutes later, he came back, and Charlotte had erased everything he'd written on the board. He didn't say anything, but you could tell he was pissed. His face just turned bright red, and he wrote everything on the board all over again.
Emma shook her head remorsefully.
He was still writing everything on the board when Miss Gardner came in. He didn't hear the door open or notice her. He just kept on writing. I felt really bad, because aren't teachers supposed to interact with students?
Laura put her face in her hands.
After 5 or 10 minutes, he was still writing on the board, Emma continued, and Miss Gardner got up and left. This time, he heard the door and turned around. We told him it was Miss Gardner, that she'd been there and left. He smiled and made a face like, very funny. Then he looked at Scarlet Wang, and she verified this was true.
Validated, Laura said, or verified.
Same difference. Anyway, so after he finds out it was Miss Gardner, he walks over to the board and pretends to bang his head against it, and Charlotte goes, somebody needs to take a chill pill, and that's when he says it. Bitches.
What's a chill pill?
It's an expression. It means you're acting like a spaz.
And then what?
And everyone laughed, except me, because it stopped being funny to me. It was like when Tanya Harding's shoelace broke at the Olympics right before she was about to go on. I felt bad for him, Mom. I really did. Emma's forehead creased with emotion. She wiggled a loose cuticle on her thumb, then ripped it off.
To tell you the truth, she said, sucking the blood off her finger, I don't blame him for saying the word, because that's what we were acting like.
Emma was troubled to arrive at school the next day and discover that Mr. Vincent, who was also her homeroom teacher, was absent. Mrs. Gregg, the permanent sub, delivered that morning's announcements and escorted her class to prayers. They filed into the auditorium in the customary 2x2 procession. Emma hadn't memorized that week's Bible verses, so as the recitation began, she mouthed the word watermelon over and over again. Next came the Lord's Prayer, which she knew by heart. After this, Miss Gardner walked to the podium and read a story about a flock of geese, who all stopped flying when one of the birds was shot by a hunter and fell to the ground. The bird didn't die, and the whole flock waited around for it to recover before resuming their journey north. When she was done, Miss Gardner asked the room what the lesson was, and, as usual, the only hands that went up were in the front, where the younger grades sat. When Emma heard Miss Gardner call on Isabel, she thought it must have been another Isabel. There were a few. But looking up, Emma saw it was the Isabel in first grade, who had stopped coming to school after being diagnosed with leukemia earlier that year. She was back. Isabel wore a headband with a bow on it, as it appeared that she was completely bald. However, as Mrs. Hudson played the opening chords to Amazing Grace, and Isabel turned to face the scroll with the words on it, her scalp caught the light, and Emma could see that her hair was growing in. Not a lot, just wisps, like a dandelion gone to seed. They were still stuck in February, but the light that filtered through the windows had a yolky glow. Spring was coming. Soon there would be blossoms on the trees, and Isabel, who was not going to die after all, would have enough hair to tuck behind her ears. To the tune of Amazing Grace, Emma contemplated the miracle of these things, and she was overwhelmed with a feeling of goodness and the blissful serenity that accompanies seeing the world through the simplicity of this lens. As the singing continued, the feeling intensified, and then, like a bolt of lightning, it suddenly occurred to Emma what really mattered in life. It wasn't about cool versus uncool, pretty versus ugly, funny versus boring, or even happy versus sad, but goodness. Goodness versus everything else that might not seem bad, but wasn't good either. To do good things, to be a good person, this was all that really counted. With a sudden clarity that felt holy, Emma considered her own life through this prism. She had done some things that were not good. She'd known this, and yet she'd done them anyway because up to this moment, she'd wanted to be like Naughty Joe in Little Women. But now, she realized, she actually wanted to be like Joe's saintly sister, Beth, and maybe she was already more like Beth than she'd thought.
"Are you crying?" Charlotte whispered.
Emma let her face speak for itself as she continued to sing. That this was her favorite of all the hymns in the rotating roster they sang in prayers was no coincidence. Amazing Grace, Isabel's hair growing back, her complicity in Mr. Vincent's unexplained absence, all of these things felt predestined to deliver her right now to this place inside of her. A place within that she'd always known was there, but had never consciously lingered. Amazing Grace ended. Emma's tears dried and the goosebumps subsided. But the feeling of goodness and the newfound belief that she was, at her core, an exceptionally good person, these sentiments remained. For the rest of the day she carried it around. It felt like a huge secret, like she'd just found out she'd won an award and couldn't tell anyone. But she didn't care, because there was no vanity in goodness. Emboldened by her new convictions, Emma cut herself off from Charlotte, and in doing so, Claire, Eleanor C., Leslie, and Ashley, who Emma now realized hadn't been her friends, but followers of Charlotte, whom everybody wanted to be around because she made things fun. The clique, or the posse, Emma learned they were called by the rest of their classmates, the social proletariat, of which she was now a member.
sitting for the first time at a different table in the lunchroom.